I support the Second Amendment. I purchased a gun when I was a young man. I've been a hunter pretty much all my life.
Can I get me a hunting license here?
I'm not a big game hunter. I made it very clear. I've always been, if you will, a rodent and rabbit hunter, all right? Small varmints, if you will.
You better say your prayers, you flea-bitten varmint!
Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi. 95.9 WATD.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, of course, your Labor Day edition. And we got some great guests coming up. Don't forget, coming up after this segment, we got Kerry Byrne and Jerry Thornton. We're going to talk a little bit of NFL. We got an upcoming season preview, so we'll talk about that with those two guys. But first, we're going to speak with a gentleman. I like to do this from time to time. I like to pull the curtain back on this thing called radio. And I've been privileged from time to time to speak with a number of my colleagues in the business. This is just another one of those instances. The gentleman who is going to be joining me for this segment, you've heard him. Whether you've heard him on radio, whether you've heard him on a movie trailer, a commercial, you name it. He's been a voice that you've heard and you'll go, oh my goodness. And it might not be just one radio station, it might be a number of radio stations. Who am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about one Pete Gustin, who is not only a fantastic radio guy, but he's a guy who does other little things like being a comedian, musician, and I believe that he has a best friend called Superdog. We could talk about that if we have time, but Mr. Gustin, how are you today?
Kevin, I'm great. I really appreciate you wanting to talk to me.
Well, I want to talk to you because you know what? Folks don't understand. I think there are things that folks don't understand about our business. There's a, you know, people think that it's something that you can just come on and voila, you are somebody who is a radio personality. There's a lot more to it. And what's even more unique is if you have something that, you know, maybe you're not able to read a script like everybody else. Maybe you don't see things the way other people do. I know that recently that you were able to kind of tell your story in regards to, I believe, a debilitating eye disease that you have, but yet you have been able to overcome that and be who you are.
Yeah, exactly. I was diagnosed at age 8 with macular degeneration, which is usually the eye disease that everybody's grandma gets. Oh, grandma's got congenitive heart failure. Oh, and macular degeneration. You know, it's something that happens to a lot of people when they get older. What's not common is when it happens to a kid, especially someone that is 8 years old and I guess in second, third grade at the time. And now they still don't know a lot about the disease, but the theory is that I was pre-programmed from birth to have my eyesight start crapping out immediately, right when I was born. And we didn't notice it until I was in about second or third grade when I kept creeping up in the classroom. Usually the kids want to hide out in the back so the teacher can't spot them. I kept bringing myself up to the front row because I couldn't see the stupid chalkboard anymore.
Right.
And they wanted to figure out what was going on. And the first couple eye doctors they took me to, get this, Kevin, they said that I was an only child, and it was a cry for attention because there was absolutely nothing wrong with my eyes.
How do you feel as a child when you're like going, I can't see, I'm having problems here, and then you have a doctor, somebody who has a degree in this stuff, saying, well, he's trying to get attention?
Well, it was a little confusing, and I'd never seen, and you're a kid, you almost kind of accept what adults tell you.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen through anyone else's eyes, and I had remembered seeing a little better a couple years earlier, but then they told me that that wasn't the case, and I was like, well, maybe I did always see like this, I don't know. So they actually gave me a pair of reading glasses, which I came to find out later were complete crap. Mm. They were just giving me something to shut me up.
Huh.
It wasn't my parents' fault at all. It was just the doctors were, it was my local regular ophthalmologist. And it wasn't until maybe just a few months later, 6 or 7 months later, we ended up at Mass Eye and Ear, when a doctor who was actually specializing in real, actual problems like macular degeneration, Stargardt's disease, retinal pigmentosis, and the like, came out of the room after doing a series of tests and said, yes, you have macular degeneration, which, of course, in 1985, when there was no internet and my Funkin' Wagnalls dictionary didn't have the term in it, we were kind of left in the dark figuratively, I suppose. Again, we didn't know exactly what the heck it was, but at least we knew I wasn't making up a story.
Correct. So what did they end up doing? Is there a treatment for it? Are they still researching this? I mean, then and now? I mean, how have things come over since that time period some 30 years ago?
It's not one of these diseases that gets the funding and research that, say, cancer or AIDS or, you know, a lot of major diseases get.
Right.
Because, again, it happens to much older people. And, you know, you're 60, 70, 80 years old and your eyes start to crap out. It's almost one of your and my eyes are going.
Right.
There's obviously a good amount of research going on. It's not the world's biggest priority, but Mass Eye and Ear, Scapin's Eye Research Institute got absorbed there. There's all sorts of institutions around the world that are working on it. But the progress from 1985 to now, from when I was diagnosed to now, I mean, the end of the road, bottom line progress is zero.
Mm.
I have no shots, no pills, no mechanisms, no implants, no glasses, nothing. I mean, there is nothing they can do. My eyesight just fades and fades and fades, and there's not a thing they can do for it.
Wait, they haven't invented the Lamar Burton visor that he used in Star Trek?
Jordan LaForge visor? No,
yes.
I know. The year 2400 or whatever the heck Star Trek takes place, and they still can't fix his eyesight.
Well, so how do you, as a child and somebody who, you know, you grow up into a man, how does this affect you from the time that you find out that you have this to where, you know, you're getting out of high school or going to head on to college? I mean, how does this affect you?
Well, I guess this is, and I'm just starting to learn this now, after releasing the video explaining how I do my job,
right,
which was never intended to be a look at me or a look what I've done. Mm. It was literally, the industry we work in is small, and it had started to get, you know, there were little rumbles, ooh, something's up with Pete, he's not like everyone else. And I was like, okay, cool, let me explain. And so I had never, ever thought of myself in any other way, other than my life is certainly more difficult than everyone else's. I don't drive a car. I can't read menus when I go to a restaurant. I mean, there's an enormous number of things that are difficult. I walk into a restaurant. I cannot find my friends. They either have to come over and get me or holler at me from across the way. I mean, it is a much, much harder life than if I were visually fully capable. But it's not something I wake up every day, sit up in bed and go, oh, crap, I'm legally blind again.
You're not a woe-is-me kind of a guy.
No, so when I was diagnosed, there was a little talk of schools that I could go to, like Perkins, I guess. And my parents like, no, you know, he's fine, because it was a degenerative eye disease.
Right.
And I didn't wake up with the eyesight I have right now. Right now is way worse than it was when I was
back
8.
Then, right, okay.
But it was slowly going. So they left me in the regular school, and I was expected to keep up with my peers, and I did. Mm. And, you know, I played soccer when I was younger, and then soccer got a little hard because the field is huge and the ball would get far away and I couldn't really see it. But by the time I got to high school, I wanted to play football, and, you know, I couldn't see the ball. I wasn't going to be able to catch pitches from the backfield or be a good defender on the ball, but I still had enough vision that I could see people and hit people. So I went to the gym a lot. I mean, a lot, because it's something I really, really wanted to do. There was no way I was going to let all of my friends play football, and I wasn't.
Right.
So I worked out and got really much, much bigger and stronger, and I came back the next year, and I said, I'm going to play nose tackle. And sure enough, I did. I started for the JV, and as a senior, I started on the varsity team. Because, again, it was just something I really, really wanted to do. And I guess that's been an unconscious theme of mine throughout my whole life. I find things that I want to do. I've got a huge obstacle in my way because I can't see what the heck I'm doing, but I just figure a way around it.
Hmm. So you were the modern day, you were the during your era, the modern day Freddie Smirlis.
Yeah, exactly.
Figuratively speaking, of course. Well, now, what led you into radio? What got you into doing what you do? Because, you know, whether folks know it or not, you are the creative services director at WEEI. You've done a lot of imaging for Entercom for a number of their radio stations. What got you involved in doing radio and doing voiceover? Did someone walk up to you one day and go, hey, young man, you got a terrific voice? What was it?
Well, there was a fundraiser that was being put on by WBZ when I was 11 years old called the Swim for Sight. And WBZ's morning host for a very long time was Dave Maynard. People in the area might remember him.
Star of the day, who will it be?
Exactly. And he was diagnosed at age 60-something with macular degeneration.
Right.
Because he had, you know, a bazillion people listening to him, he's like, I'm going to do something about this. So he put on a fundraiser. And as a little kid, a little 11-year-old, I called up one morning and said, my name is Pete Gustin, and I am macular degeneration, too. And I, you know, as this little kid, it had been up until then all these older people calling in saying, oh, my eyesight's fading, I'd like to pledge some money. So I kind of became the little mascot for the whole event. And every year we'd go to the Boston Harbor Hotel and swim a bunch of laps and raise as much money as we could. And I loved it. And I remember walking into the studio. I was brought into the WBZ studios as a little kid. Mm. And I was kind of unconsciously at the time, wasn't really thinking that much of it, but looking at the future of the eye disease. You know, Dave Maynard was an older man with macular degeneration, and he wasn't being led around, and he didn't, you know, bump into walls, and he didn't look like he was having any issues whatsoever.
Right.
He was just doing a morning show. And, you know, again, I didn't sit down at 11 years old and go, fantastic, I'll do that when I grow up.
Right,
but
right.
It left an impression on me. So that by the time I got to college and I had had those experiences with Dave Maynard and radio, and my voice had changed dramatically from 11 to 18, and people had been telling me, you've got a great voice for radio. I was like, let me put all this together. And I took my first internship when I got to college at WRKO.
Wow, you got, you know, you're lucky. You got a voice for radio. I had people who told me I have a face for radio.
What a compliment.
You lucked out, my friend. So, you know, but see, with what you have with the degenerate eye disease, was it difficult as far as being able to read scripts or put stuff together or see, you know, stuff on a screen or be able to cut tape or whatever it was that you were learning at that particular time? How was it difficult for you to be able to pick some of this stuff up, or should I say, over the time, what have you done to kind of enhance what you do to be able to do what you do so good?
Everything was harder. From the very first minute, I decided I wanted an internship. Now, I didn't end up at RKO by my first choice. I was 18 years old, loved rock music, and I actually walked into the offices of WBCN.
Oh.
And at the time, as an 18-year-old, and I don't think I've ever told anybody this story. Really wanted to be an intern there. I wanted to hang out with the morning mattress, and I loved rock music. And I walked in and I said, I want to be an intern. And they handed me a piece of paper and said, fill this out. And it was regular font on a piece of paper.
Right.
And I panicked because I could not read regular font.
Oh, goodness.
And I said, okay. And I was unprepared, which is the first lesson I learned in my life. Always be over-prepared
right.
for a situation, especially when things like this are going to sneak up on you. So I grabbed the piece of paper. I said, I actually have a class coming up. I'll fill it out and bring it back. And so I did. I left. I grabbed a little pocket magnifier that I had. I always carry with me. And, you know, embarrassed to use that in front of people because it looks weird. But I filled it out in another building, and I brought it back. And they thought I was some sort of a mental patient, so they never called me back.
Mm-hmm.
It was a short series of instances like that I started to realize, oh, brother, life is going to be different and difficult for me. Because growing up in the school system, all the teachers knew Pete Gustin is legally blind, he has the large print books, and he's going to need to sit close. And, you know, all of my friends knew. It was a small school, Winchester High School. Everybody knew, everybody understood. In the football drills, the coaches used to hold up a number of fingers for we're either going to go on one or two or three. And the coaches all knew, when it's Pete's turn, we go on one.
Mm.
Life was set up for me growing up as a kid in Winchester. And then when I got to BU and started to get out into the real world, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a lot harder.
Right.
So I had to work a lot harder. I had to prepare. I had to get ready. I had to scout things out. And I started going on auditions. And where everyone else can just walk into the audition room, grab the piece of paper, and read the script, what I was doing was I would get to the audition room a little ahead of time, say, hey, Pete Gustin, check in a little early, can I have the script? And I never explained because I didn't want to have to, oh, I'm legally blind, I need the script. I just walk in and say, can I have the script? And they say, sure. And so I would get it, and I would step into the bathroom, out of sight, out of view, down the hallway, somewhere where people couldn't see me. And I'd whip out my little pocket magnifier, and read the script as best I could and commit it to memory. So that when I walked into the room, I went so far as to pretend that I was reading it off the piece of paper because I didn't want to look any different than anyone else. So I would hold that piece of paper in front of me. For all I knew, it was upside down and backwards. I had no idea. And I would, quote-unquote, read the paper, but I was just reciting it off of memory. And that's literally how I started to break into voiceovers.
I have to ask you, just to digress for half a second but not go off topic. So let's say that you were able to be an intern, or let's say you were able to break into BCN. Who would have been some of the cool bands that you would want to announce? Who are the bands? Who are Pete Gustin's bands, rock bands that he loves?
A bunch of years later, I actually ended up working at Sirius Satellite Radio and hosted their morning show on Octane and had the opportunity to meet some of my favorite bands. I grew up. Mid-90s music was my favorite music, and I loved Stone Temple Pilots. I loved Motley Crue. I was a modern contemporary rock guy, and I started to like ZLX. I got older, a little Leonard Skinnerd, and acquired a taste for Eagles and stuff like that.
But very cool.
Stone Temple Pilots was my favorite band of all time, like Guns N' Roses, and I actually did a number of years later, in the year 2000, got to interview Scott Weiland, lead singer of Stone Temple Pilots, in New York at Sirius Satellite Radio, and it was pretty cool. It was neat to finally do something in the rock field and get to meet him.
Very, very cool. Let's get back on track as to how did you get into Entercom and be able to do the things that you do, because folks may or may not know it, but you know, you do a lot of different openings for a lot of the shows on EEI. You are also the guy who does the bits that you may hear coming out of commercial that may pertain to something that is, you know, newsworthy that might have taken place during that week, that day, that you have to whip up and put together on a moment's notice for one of the particular shows. How did you get into Entercom, and how have you thrived over there?
I got into it because I decided it was actually easier to write my own copy than read other people's, at least for a large portion of my career, and I found that I had a knack for it. I was a pretty good writer.
Copywriter.
And it came naturally to me, and I wanted to learn production. I wanted to be able to do everything. I wanted to walk into a studio, write my own copy, voice my own spot, and produce it, put it together. And I worked extraordinarily hard at that because visual editing, linear editing, requires a decent amount of eyesight. And I learned to work my way around those computers. I was interning there late in the evening for Two Chicks Dishing at the time, from 7 to 10. And after the show was over, I would find my way into a production studio, and I would work from about 10 till 2 in the morning just practicing production, working around the systems, trying to find how I could do it if I can't quite see it. And after a period of time, I became pretty proficient at it, so that by the time I graduated college, I had the skill set that they were actually willing to hire me and give me a job there. And these days, the amount of stuff that I do for not just EEI, but I also am the creative director for WRKO.
Right.
There's so much stuff that comes through my department. Every bit of imaging, even if it's not my voice, the other voice of WEEI is Brian Lee, and the other voice of WRKO is Richard Green. For a long time, it used to be Dana Hersey. Every time you hear those guys, I'm writing and creating that stuff as well.
So the
amount of stuff that you hear that is coming from my brain and my Pro Tools system is far more than I think a lot of people realize, because it's not always my voice.
So I omitted the copywriter out of the sequence of things that you do for Entercom. I apologize.
No, I figured the more that I could offer. Listen, when you go through life with a disability,
right?
And again, it's not always on my mind, but it's there. And when you know I can't do this, I can't pick up the page and read it. I can't search for this CD in this rack of CDs as quick as everyone else. You almost feel like you have to compensate all the time. And that's why I figured, all right, I'm not going to be able to do a couple other things, but listen, and this is what I said when I went for my first interview. I said, I'm going to be a top-notch writer for you. And I had a resume of writing, of great stuff. And I said, I'm going to be a top-notch production guy, and I was. I said, and I'm going to be, you know, a major market quality voice. I'm going to offer everything I possibly can to you so that you look at the fact that I'm legally blind and go, eh, that pales in comparison to everything else that he offers. So again, having the disability forced me to work much, much, I can't even emphasize, much harder than all of my contemporaries and peers who just walked in and said, I'm good at this thing, and I don't have to prove anything to anyone because I'm perfectly fine.
Right.
It really set me up to work differently than other people.
Not too long ago, I want to say the past couple of weeks, you actually released a video kind of detailing what it takes or what you had to do in order to kind of train yourself in certain ways when it came to scripts. Kind of explain what we see in the video that you put out, that that took you 2 years to be able to take a script and be able to, you know, feed it into your brain to be able to, you know, put it onto an audio wave and put it into Entercom's system.
Yeah, the video, telling the story in a non-linear fashion here, before I ended up at EEI and RKO, I had, as much as I loved production and stuff, my first love was voiceovers. I wanted to be a voiceover guy. I thought that was the most fantastic job in the world. And so I graduated Boston University, grabbed my girlfriend at the time, we went down to New York City, and I had been doing enough work that I got an interview with a major agency down there. I wanted to meet the man in person. I didn't want to call up and say, hey, I'm Pete Gustin. You've heard my voice doing some things. Legally blind, I want to come down and meet you. Because he'd be like, what? What are you talking about? So I kept that to myself. And I walked into his office, and we were having a conversation. He listened to my reel. And unbeknownst to me, someone had told him that I have a problem with my eyesight. And he was prepared for this.
Oh, goodness.
So I didn't really get very far into my conversation with him. And he throws me a packet of copy. And I'll always remember this. It was for Showtime. He said, say I get you this job for Showtime. 17 pages of copy. It's going to be a 5-6 hour session. How are you going to read it? And I was going to explain to him that, you know, I've got this pocket magnifier. I'm going to memorize it. But it started to hit me. I'm not going to be able to memorize 17 pages of copy. And he was ruthless in explaining to me, listen, kid, there's 10,000 people in line that want to do this that have as good, if not better, voices than you, and they don't have a handicap, so sorry, you're not going to make it. And he called his secretary and walked me out, and I was on the sidewalk 2 seconds later, just having been told that I would never be a voiceover guy by one of the biggest agents in the country.
Mm. Would it be easy to say, or would it be best to say, that was probably a motivating factor that drove you more?
Well, you know, the story would be better, I guess, if I told you that I walked out of there and I was like, you know, screw that guy, I'll show him. I didn't.
Okay.
I did what I think most people in America would do in the immediate aftermath of being told you can't do what you want to do, and you're only 21 years old.
Right.
I was really upset, I was really sad, and I was really despondent for, you know, it wasn't like I went into a depression for months, but, you know, I got back on the train, and I didn't know what the heck I was going to do with myself as
right.
I was going back up from New York to Boston. I knew I had my skill set as a production guy and copywriter, but to be told that I would never do voiceovers was horrifying. And as time went on for the next couple few years, I did get hired at EEI and RKO, and in that job I didn't really have to read initially. I didn't have to read a lot of other people's copy. I wrote all my own stuff, and by wrote I mean I actually just said it. I've never written my own piece of copy in my life.
Right.
I just say it into the microphone. But as time went on, I decided, you know, I've got a good voice, and I've been taking voice and articulation classes and acting lessons, and I was like, I really want to do this more. And my eyes started to fade more and more, so using the magnifier off the page of copy became more and more difficult, but I got a big, huge monitor, and I would use big, big font. But even that became an untenable way of working. When you really can't read like other people do, and you're just kind of piecing the words together the first time through, and I have to practice the copy 4 or 5 times until I've got it memorized, I started realizing I need to do something else. I need a different way to work, or that agent in New York was right. I'm never going to be able to cut it. And one day, not terribly long ago, texting had become popular, and everybody was texting on their phones. And the phones, especially then, had tiny, tiny little screens with 2-point font.
Right.
And I was totally left out. All my friends are texting. I'm like, I have no idea what you people are writing to me. It's too small. but it had a phone called the LG Envy, and the guy at the Verizon store said, oh, hey, if you hit the pound button, it reads the text to you out loud. And I was like, sweet, now I can text with everybody. I can hear what they're saying. And one night I was in the car, and I had a Red Sox update fed to me. And I was in the back of the car with three of my friends, and the text came in. I held it up to my ear and recited back. Oh, the Red Sox just beat the Yankees. David Ortiz, home run in the bottom of the ninth, walk-off run. Red Sox in first place by a game and a half. And I realized that I had just read that text out loud to all of my friends. I was reading. And it occurred to me, like, maybe I don't actually have to see this stuff to be able to read it. So I started working on a bunch of different narrator programs in my computer where I could just stick the copy, the 30 or 60 seconds of copy, into a Word document and have a voice read it to me in my ear, and then I could spit it back. And right off the bat, I realized, oh, my God, this might work. This is a way I can, quote-unquote, read copy. Now, listening to a computerized voice and delivering it back with some feeling and emotion is a task, to be sure.
Right.
Having this thing in your voice telling you what to say and then spitting it back is a long way from point A to point B, but I saw the potential of it and started to work on it immediately.
Of course, we are speaking with Pete Gustin, who you have heard a number of times on Entercom radio stations like RKO and EEI. Not just to emphasize that, tell us some of the other projects that you have been a part of, because you just don't do radio. I believe you've done movie trailers, you've done stuff for games, am I correct?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be featured in a really popular series of games called Grand Theft Auto. I was in Vice City in San Andreas, and people laugh when they, what did you play in the game? I played a radio announcer. When you hijack a car, you take a guy, you throw him on the street, and you steal his car, and you get in, you turn on the radio, there's me on the radio. And so it wasn't a big stretch, but it was a lot of fun. And those games, when they were coming out, were so ridiculously popular. To be associated with something like that was neat. And one of the very first jobs I ever got doing voice work was through a friend of a friend. I got hooked up with the Rick Dees Morning Show out in Los Angeles. And it was my job to parody Don LaFontaine. They would come out with movie trailers. He was the big, big movie trailer guy at the time.
Right.
And they'd release Lake Placid. And I would parody it the next day, Lake Flaccid. You know, we would parody all the movie trailers.
Awesome.
And Don got wind. I mean, Don, legendary in the voice. So it's, getting a call from Don LaFontaine is like being a civil servant and having Obama call you up. It's like, whoa, how did you notice me, man? And he did. He heard me parodying his stuff, and he called me up, found out I was just a kid. I was like 19 at the time, and was extremely nice, gave me tips and advice. Don has since passed, but was a real big inspiration to me to getting started in the voiceover business.
And what are some of the voiceovers that you would be most notably known for?
I was the voice of the Dan Patrick Show for the first 4 years of its existence. They since got absorbed by another company, and it's been taken over by someone else. But as that show was spreading across the country, I was the voice of the Dan Patrick Show. I'm also the voice of the, this is one of the bigger ones, the voice of the NFL and NCAA football as heard on Sports USA radio stations. So all across the country, out to Hawaii, when you turn into Saturday college football and Sunday football on your radio, there's a few different syndicators that carry the games, but I'm the voice of the Sports USA games. And through that exposure, I was able to do a Super Bowl commercial for Reebok not too long ago. I've done work for CBS Daytime's Young and the Restless. I've been on Cartoon Network's Ben 10. I've done commercials for ESPN Television. The opportunities, see, this is what I love. This is what I loved about being a voiceover guy. I absolutely love. I can work for as many people as will have me. And I get to do, like fundraisers, like we just did at WEEI. I get to do serious work and convey a serious story about kids fighting cancer. And I get to have a real serious delivery and raise money and awareness and do something good. And then in the same day, maybe in the same hour, I get to play what I did for Ben 10. I played a newscaster, and I got to talk about fiery molten blobs attacking the city and Ben Tennyson needs to save us. I mean, you get to play a whole bunch of different roles and do a whole bunch of different things. It's, you know, voiceovers. What is voiceovers? It's acting. And it's a lot of fun.
Mm. If folks wanted to find out more about you, is there a book coming out? Are you, I know that you've been doing appearances. I know that things articles have been written about you and what you've gone through. Is there anything in the works that you might be able to tell your story in a degree that will translate worldwide?
Well, the whole idea of me telling my story, Kevin, is very strange because, again, it's just what I do. Mm. It would be like if you woke up tomorrow and all of a sudden people called you and said, so let me get this straight. You walk outside your house, open the door to a car, push a gas pedal, and navigate your way to the radio station? You'd be like, yeah, man, that's what I do to get here. I mean, this is just, it's just what I do. You know, I wanted to read the copy. I couldn't read the copy. Yep. So I came up with a solution. But the response that I've gotten off of the video has been totally unexpected and unreal to me, that these people are taking, you know, like I just said, what I do as an inspiration. And I've been getting emails from all over the world, a paraplegic in India, a woman who was just diagnosed with a different type of eye problem in Argentina. I've done interviews on radio in the UK, New Zealand, and all these people want to hear how I overcame. And I don't think the important thing is how I did, but the fact that I just wanted to, that I did, that I tried. And I guess people are getting, I guess they're getting inspiration out of that. And I think that's great. I think it's neat. If I can inspire people, cool.
If folks wanted to see the video of you kind of explaining this, breaking this down, and learning more about you, is there somewhere that they get a link or a website they can go to?
My main website is PeteGustin.com. I did, because of the popularity of the video, the amount of people wanting to see it, I stuck it right on the homepage. And I have actually been asked, and I've started booking some speaking engagements. I'll be telling my story. I've got some engagements in Boston, Washington, D.C., and Las Vegas. And one of the people on the speaking circuit was like, you need to write down your story. People are gonna get something out of this. And again, I'm 36 now. I had never thought of myself in any other way other than just some guy doing what he needed to do to make a living and not have to live at home in his parents' basement.
Right.
But if it's a story people want to hear, again, I'm not going to run out in front of the world and say, look at me. But if it's something that people want to hear, I'm more than happy to share it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking time to sit down and talk with us this evening about your story, and we'll definitely look forward to hearing more about you, and would love to maybe have you back on in a couple of months as you kick off your world tour.
Well, I appreciate it. It's a real honor. Like I said, it's a real honor that people even want to talk to me, so I appreciate you having me on.
Pete Gustin, make sure you check him out. Check out the PeteGustin.com to check out that video. We're going to step aside. When we come back, more of Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.